initially drew you and the Faith and Leadership team to focus on innovation?
So partly it was born out of a sense that there were too many, there was too much despair on the one hand of a kind of ain't it awful mode. And there was also too much talk of just having to start everything from scratch. And so I was intrigued by the people who seemed to both having continuity with their work and ways of going forward in fresh and new ways. And so it was partly born out of conversations I'd had with Ron Heifetz in the late 90s, where he said, you know, everybody talks about my work on adaptive change and nobody pays attention to where that comes from in evolutionary biology, that you actually focus as much on what to preserve as what to change. And so we were, you know, that really resonated with me. And I began to say, okay, that's where we need to really pick up some core themes. And I began to be fascinated by those people who didn't seem to be just making stuff up or leading change. People who were figuring out how to do fresh things that were also in continuity with their own organizations. And so as we began to tell some of those stories, we began to realize how much was at stake in cultivating the imagination.
So imagination you saw as a really core piece of innovation.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that was actually something, you know, I like to use the image of Pink Floyd's album cover from Dark Side of the Moon, that you see the light coming in, hitting the prism, and then you see the rainbow on the other side, that actually the physics of the light doesn't change. What changes is the hitting of the prism. Uh-huh. And it enables you to see things in a much more rich array of colors. Uh-huh. And that's the imagination. How do you see an existing organization not as a problem or as something that's got inevitable decline, as an asset that can stir a way to see all the rich rainbow of colors?
You developed or are developing this idea of traditioned innovation. You want to tell us what that is and about your book project on it?
Well, the idea came out of just this anxiety that too many people thought innovation was making stuff up from scratch. And I sometimes say that's like a middle school band concert. Nobody wants to go to that, even the parents. That, you know, what's really creative and innovative is more like Preservation Hall in New Orleans, when you have really gifted people who bring all their talents and awareness in a way that genuine creativity emerges. And I had been worried that there was too much focus on the newness and not enough on the continuity beforehand. And Ron Heifetz's description about, you know, evolutionary biology. And so I started to play around with the phrase traditioned innovation in my mind. And Yaroslav Pelikan had this distinction in his Jefferson lecture where he said, tradition is the living faith of the dead. Traditionalism is the dead faith of the living. And I realized that there are lots of people in congregations who encounter traditionalism and then say, oh, I'm sick of that. And so then throw the baby out with the bathwater. And as I developed this phrase, I had lunch with a good friend of mine, a New Testament scholar named Kavin Rowe, who said, I said, what comes to your mind when you hear the phrase traditioned innovation? And he said, well, the book of Acts. And I thought, this is encouraging, since he'd written a book on the book of Acts. And then he said, well, actually, Luke and Acts. And I thought, progress. And then he said, the Gospels and Acts. And then he paused and he said, actually, you could tell the entire biblical story as a story of traditioned innovation. And when he said that, I thought, well, that's right, because only God creates out of nothing. Only God does pure innovation. The rest of us are always reacting, responding, building off. And the key is how to distinguish what needs to be cast aside, what needs to be allowed to die because it's traditionalist or sinful, and what needs to be preserved. And when I began to think about that, I began to realize that in my own leadership, the best things I'd ever done were when I'd spent time to try to understand what was the DNA of the institution and the organization that needed to be preserved, and then how could we do new things that could build off of that. And some of that was storytelling in ways that people could say, oh, this isn't just taking making a radical departure. It's actually part of who we've been in a new key. One of the things I like to use when I'm doing workshops is John Coltrane. There's a YouTube video of John Coltrane playing My Favorite Things from The Sound of Music. And, you know, it's this unbelievable piece where you start out and you're going, oh, yeah, I know this song. And then he takes you on these riffs and this journey and you're like, whoa, where are we? And then he comes back to the core melody and you're like, okay, got it again. And so you begin to realize just the richness that's there, and then how much of innovation depends on a kind of deep formation and traditioning process, because the deeper you understand what's gone before you, the more creative you can be going forward, which is why I love the kind of jazz resonance, because you really want people who've got the skills of a Miles Davis or a John Coltrane.
Right. They know their scales, so to speak.
Yes, indeed. Yeah.
Well, what would you say then to people who would say, well, part of that tradition is really corrupted by certain things? What do we do about that? How do we discern what to build on and then what to let go of from the tradition?
Yeah, I think that's where it's an ongoing process of what is sinful that needs to be cast aside, what has lived a useful purpose but is no longer relevant, and how do you develop it in a new key? And that's an ongoing process of debate, discernment, discussion, that you've got to be engaged in. And sometimes you'll make mistakes. You know, I've worked with a number of jazz combos when I've done presentations, and, you know, sometimes they'll go on a riff and all of a sudden they'll be looking at each other and you go, uh-oh, this isn't going so well.
We got to get out of this.
That's right. And then what you do is you go back to the core, and then you say, okay, let's start again and let's explore again. And the better you get at it, the more experimental you are, and the quicker you can make adjustments to where things have gone awry. Because innovation's never going to be 100% successful. It's always iterative, and there are some things that are going to work really well and other things that are just going to bomb. And you just want to stay in that iterative mode. One of my favorite stories from Greg Boyle at Homeboy Industries out in LA, they started this bakery, Homeboy Bakery, to help get some of the gang kids a job. And it was going really well, and they started a t-shirt shop, and it was going really well. So he thought, we're on a roll, and he started Homeboy Plumbing. And it turns out that there were not many people who wanted gang kids coming into their homes with metal pipes. And so that didn't work so well. And so, you know, they stopped doing that and tried some other things. So you're never going to be 100% successful.
Could you tell us a story about a congregation that's doing something innovative?
Yeah, I think as I reflected on it, I'd talk about Broadway United Methodist Church in Indianapolis and Mike Mather, who's recently written a little book that kind of describes some of their activities. It's a church with a long storied history. Back in the 1950s, it was one of the largest churches anywhere in the country. And then it suffered significant decline. The neighborhood changed. And Mike had actually been there as an associate a number of years ago, and then was asked to come back about, I guess, 25 years ago, I think, as a senior pastor. And when he got there, the church was in decline. But it also had a storied history. And so it wasn't just kind of a new church start, but he also knew that it needed to have new life brought into it. And I'd highlight, I think, probably three stories. One was, he knew they needed to get to know the neighborhood better. Mm-hmm. And so he hired a guy whose job description was roving listener and asked him to go out and just spend time in the neighborhoods and learned that there were lots of talents there. It was asset-based community development kind of questions. And, you know, rather than asking about the needs, he started asking about, what do you know how to do? What would you like to connect with the church about? And out of that, and out of those relationships, they've developed both a kind of mini classroom where they bring people on Saturdays and say, what do you have expertise in and that you think three or four people might be interested in learning from you? And out of that, they've found people who've actually started some businesses, including a woman who had a gift for cooking that they used as a caterer. She now does a lot of catering and so has created employment. That's one component of it. The second piece was that they discovered that, you know, they had a lot of empty space. The way Mike tells it, there are 27 bathrooms in the facility. That just gives you a sense of the scale of the church. And so what they've done is they've used some of the spaces there as incubators, co-working spaces, artist studios that brings the community in and has also energized people around the neighborhood to see the church in a new light. And the third thing they did that I thought was quite remarkable was they realized that if they wanted to do the kind of relationship building and the kind of transformational work they thought was necessary, they needed to stop doing some things that weren't focused in the right direction. So they actually ended their soup kitchen and clothing closet and thrift shop. And the way they did it was really remarkable because they wanted to honor all the people who'd invested time and all the identity that'd gone in the past And they had a service to celebrate those gifts as they also acknowledged the ending of that work. Now what they do is they won't give handouts. They don't give rent assistance. They don't give food. What they will do is if somebody comes with those needs, they say, well, could you come back tomorrow and bring three people who love you? And what they do is then talk with those people in a way that says, now, how can we help you find a job? How can we help you find permanent housing? How can we work together? So they're still investing resources, and they're doing it in a way that's more focused on transforming the people's circumstances, giving them more affirmation, so that the congregation has a very different relationship to its constituents, to its members, and to the whole neighborhood. You know, that's included working on some other innovative things, like they convinced, I think it was Sprint, to put a tower, use their steeple as a tower that now gives Wi-Fi to a 12-block area around the church. Pretty remarkable stuff that has been really transformational.
Well, what are the ways in which faith and leadership has engaged congregations around innovation? What do you guys actually do with congregations?
The first thing we do is try to tell stories that stir imagination. So when we learn and engage, and so the first thing we do is through faith and leadership, that kind of storytelling that can help illumine, stir mm-hmm. the imagination. Our Foundations of Christian Leadership program is a program that takes pastors and other Christian leaders through a journey to help them discover some of the vocabulary and skills to do this kind of work. And then occasionally we'll do workshops and actual direct engagement, you know, with congregations, because the formation process is really crucial, cultivating the imagination within a congregation to actually see what's at stake.
Are there certain issues that you think you see churches that are prickly appropriate to work on in terms of innovation?
I think that the worst forms I see are when it's seen as a kind of Hail Mary desperation act, either to generate revenue or become relevant or reach young adults.
You know, kind of
tactical thing that they think it's a fix-it technique. The places where it's best is where it's seen as an expression of the identity and mission of the congregation in a core way that helps transform self-understanding. I think there are some key images that are crucial to that. One is for 50 to 60 years, we've had largely mechanistic images of organizations, and especially larger churches. Small churches tend to still think of themselves as communities. But once you get an organization chart, you tend to move into a mechanistic model. And that metaphor tends to think that change is an option. So you can either be inert or you can change. And not many people prefer change or innovation just as a kind of default mode. If, however, we turn to metaphors that would be more biblical, which would be actually more rooted in organic imagery, then change is inevitable. And so the question is, how are we growing? How are we doing new things? Sometimes that involves pruning. That means stopping doing some things, not necessarily just because they're bad or sinful, but stopping doing some things because they're not enabling the full flowering of what the church's mission could be. That was one of the things I learned. I'm a terrible gardener, but when we were trying to learn, I was trying to learn how to work with a rose bush, and went to a gardener, and she told me about pruning, and she said, cut that branch. And I said, but that one looks pretty healthy. And she said, it's fine, but it won't, the bush won't really flower unless you cut it. And I said, but it's not dead. And she said, if you only cut dead things, you're not pruning. So the biblical metaphors can really help us in seeing that the options aren't change versus no change. It's how do we innovate in ways that enable us to fulfill our mission.
Has working with congregations changed the way you think about innovation at all?
I'd say both congregations and other institutions. Because one of the things I've learned is actually that I don't like the word entrepreneurship. I mean, I'm okay with it. That's the term that became really popular with a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And that gives too much of a sense that you have to start something new from your garage, or, you know, best way to do anything is with no history. And one of the things I've really appreciated is learning how the story of a past with all of its complexities can be the soil out of which real innovation comes. I'm fine with church planters and people who start new things. We need to do a lot of that. But when you privilege that, you tend to think what exists as is somehow unredeemable.
Right. Yeah.
Not transformable. Every congregation has a story. And many of them, if not most of them, have had, in Catholic terms, a charism, you know, something that really marked their life together. And to uncover that and then nurture that can really be transformational. My worry about the word innovation is too much of it has just become doing something new for newness's sake. Mm-hmm. You know, just deciding to start a new worship service isn't necessarily innovation in the way I like to use the term, because innovation ought to be trying to transform the equilibrium. It's not just a new technique. One of my favorite examples was when I went to a Presbyterian church in an area of North Carolina that's got a lot of retirees. And so the average age was pretty old, and they decided that they needed to do a contemporary worship service to get young families. And instead what they had was a service where, you know, a bunch of old people in leaning on canes and walkers were standing to sing praise music that none of them liked. That's not what I consider innovation. That's a desperate technique to try to find young people.
Yeah, and not very discerning for that community.
No.
What's innovation like at Faith and Leadership? Have you tried something, failed, had revised something you were doing as an organization?
Yes, multiple times. And in varieties of ways, as we learn, sometimes, like with any kind of incubator, you got great ideas that you sit around talking about. And then when you actually try to implement them, you realize there were things you'd never thought of. And so we've had to adapt even the Foundations of Christian Leadership program. We had to adapt the kind of time frame, the accessibility, how people could work. We used to have it all in Durham. Now we do a lot of it in other locations, so that we've done a whole program just that was Houston-based and another one that was Boston-based. The other example would be that we've done some experiments in terms of how we gather people, trying to see if there were ways to bring teams together to work on problems together. We've learned from some other organizations like BridgeSpan and how they worked on things. So we try to learn from lots of different groups. Sometimes I'd say probably the ideas I thought were most likely to be really great were the ones that died stillborn, and the ones that were kind of like a halfway hunch that I thought, well, it won't hurt to try, are the ones that really have gotten traction.
You know, our focus in our initiatives on vocation, helping people in congregations discern God's calling, what do you think is the relationship or the connection between innovation and vocation?
So I think a lot of that, it centers around God, and that's the first tie. I mean, there are ways to talk about vocation and ways to talk about innovation that both become kind of story loops that become narrowly construed. Vocation degenerates into career, innovation degenerates into technique. And I think both of them get connected when you're thinking about God. I was actually talking with a foundation executive in North Carolina who supports rural churches, and somebody in the meeting was asking him, those churches that have done the most transformational work, in this case, it was around literacy, what was different about them than other churches? And he said, well, the first thing I'd say is that those churches that are centered in God tend to be more transformational than those that are centered on themselves. And I thought at one level, that seemed like the simplest, most straightforward thing to say. And then I just kept thinking about it and thinking, that's really profound. And it points to the fact that not enough churches are centered in God, that they kind of stand out in that way. And so I'd say the same thing about vocation, that it begins to become an expression of who you are. And in the same way that vocation is a journey that you can't anticipate next steps because God's full of surprises, so also with a journey of innovation. Mm-hmm. And they're both rooted in stories, and that you have to continually learn how to tell and retell. And both are rooted in the larger story from creation to new creation.